Thank you, presenters, will give us a good example of how bankers and community groups can work together to provide financial literacy training. John Bryan is the founder, chairman, and CEO of Operation Hope, which is America's first nonprofit social investment banking organization and a leading national self-help provider of economic empowerment tools and services for the underserved and wealthless. Since his founding in 1992, John has raised more than $40 million in grant funding and more than $200 million in lending commitments for low-wealth homeownership and small business creation. John works in active partnership with more than 250 banks, insurance companies, credit unions, and corporations, along with the government and community leaders, and directs the activities of 9 nonprofit Operation Hope initiatives operating in 9 states, 15 cities, and the District of Columbia. John has received over 400 awards and citations and has been cited by the past 4 sitting presidents for his work to educate, inspire, and empower low-wealth communities nationwide. He is an author, businessman, a former United Nations Goodwill Ambassador to the United States. He is also the author of a new movement in America called the Civil Rights Movement. He's also served as a keynote speaker at this conference in 2003. Art Shingleton has been in banking since 1964. His management career in banking began in 1972 at Crocker Bank in Los Angeles, California. He received a teaching credential from UC Berkeley in 1979 and taught money and banking at Laney Junior College in Oakland. Art joined the Bank of the West in 1983, where he is currently Senior Vice President and Manager of Community Affairs. John?
Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, the first thing necessary for a successful program is a little passion. Good morning.
Good morning.
Now you're all honorary black people. I am from a black church, and in the black church, we're kind of used to seek and respond. So I'm not here to talk at you. I'm here to talk with you. Anyway, it's a free speech. So I'm going to try this one more time. Good morning.
Good morning.
Now we're finally coming alive. I want to thank all of you for being here for this important day. And I want to thank you for the invitation as well. I don't know if ING is in the room. But my partnership with ING, which now spans across the country, but is rooted in Atlanta, Georgia, we've now educated over 10,000 children in financial literacy education, started with this conference 2 years ago. So PhDs are good, but PhDs are even better. I think that when I think about the issue of financial literacy and I ask myself, is there a problem? I have to honestly say, yes, there is. Primarily because some of you view it and some of your institutions view it as a program. The very nature of a program, and by the way, if you're just using my voice, I traveled 20 hours today's Tuesday. I traveled 20 hours on Sunday to get to Louisiana for meeting with the governor yesterday and to tour the state, and then to come here late last night. And so sometime in the next few minutes, my voice will come back to me, but again, please excuse me. Actually, that's part of the presentation, so I'll bring that in. But to suggest a program is to suggest structure, a certain amount of the known, a certain science, a certain system that's in place that you can program, that you can commoditize, that you can make wholesale, as the gentleman just suggested. Well, I'm going to suggest that this is more of an art than a science. I'm also going to suggest very strongly that this is not a program, this is a priority. This is a national crisis. According to the Federal Reserve, 80% of the U.S. economy is on the back of the U.S. consumer. That's you and me buying coffee, refrigerators, paying car notes, coming to this conference, paying for airplane tickets. Let's reduce this down to that which we can understand. Buying food, clothes, it's consumer spending. And whenever we become deer's caught to economic headlights, this economy comes to a grinding halt. How do you say 9/11 post for 90 days? Nobody bought anything anywhere. Let's go one step further. People say, well, that's kind of their issue. Well, first of all, let me step back and suggest for those who believe this is a program, those are the same people who probably watched the FEMA commercial a few weeks ago. Anybody here know what the FEMA commercial is? That's where the gentleman, very well-intentioned, from FEMA said to the victim in New Orleans, where do I wire your $2,000 allocation from FEMA? That person, obviously, well-intentioned as they were, did not understand that there are 70 million people who don't have bank accounts, a good number of them in Louisiana and Mississippi. How do you ask somebody who doesn't have a bank account where I'm going to wire your funds into? And what happens when you take somebody who makes $9,800 a year and you give them, without any financial literacy education, and they are dumb and they aren't stupid. You got to be savvy to be poor in America. I'll repeat that. You got to be savvy to survive poor in America. That didn't resonate with you the way I thought it should. Let me just add, in other words, let me start bringing it home. If you're living in California or New York, and you're making less than $50,000 a year, you are struggling just to make ends meet. Can I get an amen? Okay. If you're living in Atlanta, Georgia, and making $35,000 a year, you are struggling to make ends meet. Can I get an amen? Amen. So it doesn't matter whether you're white, black, red, brown, or yellow. It's about managing green. So it's not about whether you're dumb or you're stupid. It's what you don't know that you don't know that's killing you. There's an old Southern saying, no matter how much I love you, my son or my daughter, if I don't have wisdom, I can only give you my own ignorance. And so out of love, we pass down bad habits from generation to generation. A blind town, a one-eyed man's king. If you don't know better, you cannot do better. So these people in New Orleans were dumb. You gotta be savvy to survive poor in America. But what they were financial illiterate. And what somebody should have done was said, look at me. I'm gonna have a conversation with you. You're gonna get $2,000, you're gonna get it twice, you're gonna get it three times, you're gonna get it once. You need this for housing, spell housing, H-O-U-S-I-N-G. If you don't use this money for housing, you're gonna have a problem. And you're too smart to put yourself and your family in that boat. And I think if they had had that conversation, people would have focused. But they didn't have the conversation. Now, what do you do if you make $9,800 a year, you've never seen $2,000 in one time before in your life? What do you do? Be honest, you go shopping. Now, you take that same person and send them to Atlanta, Georgia, ain't never been out of New Orleans before in their life, you might as well give them a Eurorail pass. Now, my white friends can't say it, I can say it. They went shopping. But they were dumb and they were stupid. It's what they didn't know that they didn't know that was killing them. And so this issue affects not only the person in New Orleans, which was the epitome of a financial literacy crisis in America. But this issue goes all the way up to your doorstep. Let me see if I can bring this home. If you were middle class 40 years ago, your parents, middle class was one parent working, back, not gray, blue collar worker, and one parent staying home as a domestic engineer to raise your children. But if you're middle class today, it's two parents working. It's brain, not back, and you are not making any more money. Are you with me? And so we're living in an economic era. I've said before, I said just yesterday, and Pastor Andrew Young, the civil rights hero that was in the right arm of Martin Luther King Jr., was with me yesterday in Baton Rouge meeting with the governor. And we said that the 20th century was about issues of race and the color line all over the world and what we call civil rights. The first civil right was the right to vote. By the way, post-grad people say, well, what happened in New Orleans was about race. That wasn't about race, that was about class, poverty, and indifference. Now, is race a tax on poverty? You betcha. Is racism a tax on poverty? You betcha. But there's more poor white people in America than poor black people. And if that happened in Appalachian and not New Orleans, you'd have 1,000 dead poor white people and not 1,000 dead poor black people. So we're all in this together. Back to the story. By the way, what was that story? I'm serious. What was the last thing I read? Andrew Young, thank you very much. So if the 20th century is about issues of race, you think I got a script up here? If the 20th century was about issues of race and color line all over the world, from South Africa to South America to the southern states, and what we call civil rights, the first civil right was the right to vote, and other civil rights followed, then I'm going to suggest to you today that the 21st century and economic era is going to be about issues of class and poverty. Class and poverty are what I call silver rights, S-I-L-V-E-R, the silver rights movement. And the first silver right is financial literacy. If you don't know better, you cannot do better. Number one cause of divorce in America? Money. The fastest group of bankruptcy filers used to be youth between 18 and 24. And by the way, those were not black kids. Those were white, middle-class college students going to college to get a master's degree in psychology, an undergraduate degree in bankruptcy, paying for their pizza with a credit card, believe the check is a form of credit, and calling home to you for more money. But now the biggest bankruptcy filing group is, you just said it, as a new market, senior citizens. That's the fastest growing of bankruptcy filers in America. Do you know that more people filed for bankruptcy in 2002 than graduated from college? So this is everybody's problem. Now let me flip the script and fast forward to what I call market opportunity. This is why I believe you have to focus on this. And it's not just a goody-two-shoes issue. It's not just a program. This is something you cannot give up on. According to the Department of Commerce, 75% of all children born today are under the age of 10 in this country are ethnic minority children. I'll repeat that. 75% of all children today under the age of 10 in this country are ethnic minority children. Translation, in 7 to 10 years, they're your customer. Now, unless you want a larger and larger share of a smaller and smaller marketplace, you better figure out how to do business with somebody who's black, brown, or different. I tell my black brothers and sisters, you better learn to put some salsa on your barbecue. And we're all in this thing together. I tell brothers all the time, what do you think Puerto Rican is? If not too Spanish to be black, too black to be Spanish. So wherever you go, we can get back to this concept of enlightened self-interest. It's in all of our enlightened self-interest. Don't do it because it's good for me. Don't do it because it's charity. Do it because it's good business. Diversity has always been a business strength. That's another speech, so I won't bore you with that here. So financial literacy is the baseline, the first civil right, but home ownership is also a civil right. Small business wealth is a civil right. Health and wellness is a civil right. Spiritual wealth is a civil right. Well, John, what does spiritual wealth have to do with this? There's a difference between being broke and being poor. Being broke is economic, but being poor is a disabling frame of mind and a depressed condition of our spirit, and we must vow never, ever, ever to be poor. Again, unless you don't understand poverty, you'll never understand how to affect and address underserved communities. Notice me, I didn't say black communities. I didn't say brown communities. I didn't even say low-income communities, because it's not about low income, it's about low wealth. If you make $30,000, but you live on 20, you're better than somebody who makes $1 million, but living in a million pond. Okay, you'll get that later. So it's not about making more money or making better decisions with the money you make. That's financial literacy education, and it is at every level of the economic strata. This affects policy. I was talking to President Bush, and said, with all due respect, Mr. President, how do you expect somebody to manage their own Social Security account if they can't manage their own checking account? How do you expect to put 5 million people in a home? You can put 5 million people in a home, but you can't keep them in a home unless they're financially literate. So what we do in Operation Oak and these Hope Centers, by the way, how many here are partners of Operation Oak? Okay, we got to change that. I need a majority in the room in about 2 years. Thank you, Gary, Art, all you guys. Thank you very much, Kramer, et cetera, et cetera. So what do we do in a Hope Center? Convert a check-cashing customer to a banking customer. Convert a renter into a homeowner. Convert a small business dreamer into a small business owner. Convert a minimum wage worker to a living wage worker with new job skills. Convert the economically uneducated to the economically empowered. Moving people up and out of poverty. What does that? The power of conversion is the grease that oils the gears of economic empowerment, and that's financial literacy. In this age, education is the ultimate poverty eradication tool. If you don't know better, you cannot do better. Am I going too fast? Pat Harris, am I doing all right? So what I'm suggesting here is that financial literacy in an economic era is the mechanism by which you convert the underserved into the served. Move somebody from the tax rolls to the from the poverty rolls to the payroll. Let me give you some examples. Union Bank of California. They came to me and said, we want to buy a check cashier. I said, don't do it. It'll ruin your franchise. It'll drag your stock in the mud. But they said, well, these branches are cost effective. I said, don't do it. I said, well, John, what do you suggest we do? I said, make us a partner and get out of the check cashing business and into the conversion business. And so they made us a 5% equity owner. They bought 45% of Nick's check cashers, the most ethical check casher in South Central LA. They will cash a check for 1%, and if you open a bank account, they'll cash a check for free. And we got out of the check cashing business and into the conversion business, converting a check cashing customer into a banking customer. By the way, there's an opportunity for any bankers in Louisiana around this topic. But back to you, Bank of California. So what did we do? We partnered with Bank of California. We cross-trained their tellers. We incentivized the tellers to convert check-cashing customers to banking customers. We put our operation inside of their operation to serve as the grease and oil and gears of economic empowerment, kind of the private banking for the working poor. And kind of became a Kinko's for economic empowerment. And what are the results? Last year, 2004, Union Bank reported that they opened 40,000 new deposit accounts in all six states. But 4,000 of those accounts, or 10%, was opened by us in South Central Los Angeles at Nick's Check Cash. So we were responsible for 10% of all new deposit accounts in Union Bank, California, converting a check cashing customer into a banking customer. We also, in 2002, became the first nonprofit in history to build a bank branch and sell it to a bank. We built a Hope Center in South Central Los Angeles. People said it couldn't be done. And Hope Centers now serve 500,000 people. Those 7 Hope Centers, by the way, there's one that we have, we'll talk about in a minute, with my friend Art Sheila Lanier, who's a visionary in the West, in the Fruitberry area of Oakland. We have one in that third world country called Anacostia, outside of Washington, D.C., on Good Hope Road. And, well, y'all are really slow. Good Hope Road. Operation, okay, anyway. So we have these 7 Hope Centers that are across the country. We serve 500,000 people. We have now funded $145 million in loans, $245 million in loan approvals. The difference between the fundings and the approvals are the forward commitments, because people can't afford to buy a home in California, as an example, because the affordability index has gone through the roof. But $145 million in loans, 1,000 homeowners, 250 small business owners, and in 11 years, not one home loan has ever gone bad. Now, these aren't subsidized loans. These are market rate loans. But the match is financial literacy education. On the front end, we somebody walks into the front door, we approve them day one, which you cannot do with the bank, which is why I suggest you partner with a nonprofit. We approve them day one, subject to the resolution of their own of their primary denial package. So Jesus didn't judge you, he met you where you were, said, let's go from here, because a saint is a sinner that got up. And so when you walk in the front door, we put your credit report. And we say, ooh, baby. Looks like a bus accident. But it's okay. A saint is a sinner that got up. Give them their dignity. Because there's a difference between being broke and being poor. So we dignify the person by approving them day one, subject to the resolution of their primary denial package. It's not a giveaway program. It's a hand-up strategy, not a hand-out strategy. Then, like a doctor, we prescribe what is their primary denial factors and put them in the credit, the case management program, a credit counseling program, a financial planning program, a dollar-for-dollar matching grant program. Who puts up the dollar-for-dollar matching grant? Is it charity? Is it the government? It's the bank. Why? Because it costs you $3,000 to $5,000 to market to a new long-term customer through traditional means. But if you give the money to me, we'll give you a charitable credit. We're going to give you CRA credit. You become a hero or a shero in your local community. Because we're going to amplify your message. We're going to tell your story like you can never tell your story before. And when we finish working with that borrower over 18 months on average to resolve their primary denial factors and give them a 100-point bump on their FICO score, hello, can you do that on your own? By the time we finish with them, they're like a new shining penny. And you've got not only all of those businesses that just articulate to you, but now you get a first shot to fund that loan, which now has an acceptable FICO score, and every lender in town is fighting over themselves to fund a loan that nobody wanted to fund before. And when you fund that loan with reasonable fees and interest, guess what you get back? And $5,000. Because through reasonable fees and interest, you're going to recoup the money you put up in the first place. So we funded now about $20 million in new home loans through a fund of about $750,000 in dollar-for-dollar matching grants. So through this process of working somebody through 18 months, revitalizing their spirit and their financial profile, it's not about your credit report, it's about your credit report. I'm using some good stuff on you guys, and I mean this is slack. I mean slack. We move people from the poverty road to the poverty road, from the poverty road to the payroll, moving people up and out of poverty. And what we do there, they hit your balance sheet as profitable, a consistent revenue stream that you can cross-sell. And there's a difference between my mother as a customer and me as a customer, okay? When I own a home, it's an investment. When my mama owns a home, it's, you know, her dream. My mama used to always say on the front, we used to hang out on the front lawn of our house, you better get off my porch with that mess and underline my. When you create a new homeowner through financial literacy, you create a policeman on that block with pride and ownership. You create a venture capitalist with equity in their house to send their kids to college or start a business. You create a new taxpayer. You create a new voter. You don't need Jesse Jackson to do a voter turnout drive. You need more homeowners. Because in South Central LA, you had 35% who owned homes after the riots in 92, but the voter turnout rate was 38%. It wasn't a black homeowner. It wasn't a brown homeowner. It was a green homeowner. Pat knows he was chief operating officer of the LA Urban League during the riots. So I'm suggesting that all these pieces are beginning to come together. Let me now talk very briefly about market opportunity. Now, Jason, 2 minutes, 1 minute, what? Make up your mind. Okay. Let's look at the market opportunity. A place like Detroit, a place like Pittsburgh, a place like Harlem, a place like South Central LA. Now, your traditional marketplaces have banks on every corner, grocery stores on every corner. They're overserved. Can we agree on that? But you can get a place like Harlem. Now look at this. Harlem is you have New York City islands. You got Central Park. You have the West Side of Manhattan. You have the East Side of Manhattan, Lower Manhattan, and Harlem.
Okay, do that. I'm gonna do that one more time. Just promise me, I'm sorry. Gary, keep me honest here. Let me see if I can do this right. White folks, black folks. But with increasing wealth and increasing population and finite land, after a while, white folks say black folks are not so bad. Do you know they are selling $1 million townhomes on 125th Street today? A tear down in Harlem is $500,000, and they gave it to you 10 years ago. It's not a black or brown community, it's an underserved community. And if we keep going like the way we're going, Harlem's gonna be a historical district with two signs on two houses in 5 years that said black folks once lived here. And so nobody took Harlem for us. I'll say it, we gave it away because we were financially illiterate. And so we've gotta reclaim our own lives. It's not just what you do for us, it's what we do for ourselves. And so, but this renaissance is happening in the inner cities, I guarantee you. You go to black churches, what are they talking about? Empowerment, ownership, financial literacy. This message is spreading throughout the community, but is it spreading throughout the financial community? I don't have time to give you some more examples, but I think you're beginning to get the message. And what I'm suggesting here is it's a market-driven opportunity. South Central LA is not inner city LA. It's 15 centrally located real estate. It's 15 minutes from the port, the freeway, the downtown, the beaches, the port. It is centrally located real estate. It became South Central when black folks moved there. So these are market opportunities. And I suggest to you that in the 21st century, your institution, in order to be competitive, is going to have to try to figure out how to be innovative and little out of the box. This is the democratization of credit. That's what it is. And when your ancestors came to the equivalent of Ellis Island, they were immigrants too. Hello? And when they came in, there were no products for them. There were no equity loans. There were no credit cards. There were no mortgage loans. There were no lines of credit because it didn't exist. What happened? People innovated. People responded to the marketplace. They didn't say it's a program. They said it's an opportunity. And so the Bank of Italy became Bank of America on the back of immigrants. This is your opportunity, folks. This is your financial institution's opportunity, and it's a once in a lifetime shift in our economic model. On that point, I'd like to now shift to a best practice with Operation Hope. We have 260 financial service partners with $4.5 trillion in assets between them. One of them is Bank of the West, my friend Art Shingleton. Now, you don't do business with companies, you do business with people. So it's not about Bank of the West or E-Trade or Fremont Investment or Citigroup or any of these institutions. It's about individuals within these institutions who get it. And so Art Shingleton was the person who anchored our relationship. And yes, the CEO is on my board of directors, Don McGrath, but it's Art who I call when I need to engineer a innovative partnership. So like every partnership, you have things that work well, things that don't work not so well, and things that are average. Now what you don't want is a lot of average. I would say mistakes are okay because you learn from them. But even the Bible says be hot or be cold, if you're lukewarm, I'll spat you out. So even Jesus got tired of mediocrity. So that's why I said be passionate. Whatever you're going to do, be passionate about it or don't do it. So we have an example of three financial literacy partnerships. One is in Portland, Oregon, with primarily a blue-collar working white population. And that partnership, I think we both say, has not worked out to our expectation. Is that fair, Art?
That would be fair.
And we both taken responsibility for why it didn't work out. And we're not going to get into details, but let's just say there was a person within one of our organizations that weren't passionate about the mission. They were just going through the motions. And they got exactly what they put into it. Absolutely nothing. But we have another partnership in Oakland, California for Banking on Our Future. And there, the program is thriving. And then we've got, we're going to learn from the best and the good and the well-organized. And we're now going into Denver in 06 to open an office there. By the way, we have 17 offices in 17 cities and states, and we're about to go internationally into Africa. And we've now formed a national partnership with Bank of the West. And then to kind of prove that financial literacy should lead to something, we now have a Hope Center in Oakland, California, that's converting check cashing customers into banking customers and renters into homeowners and small business dreamers into small business owners in a formerly unbanked area. I'd like you all to not only welcome Art Shingleton, but please, on behalf of all underserved communities, please thank him for his bold and profound leadership. Thank you, Art.
Well, how would you like to follow John Bryan? What is it that I can say, you know, other than thank you, John, and it's a privilege to be here, as well as to partner with Operation Hope. I'm not going to go over all the numbers and the kinds of discussion that we've talked about. What I'm going to say is that I'll take it to the personal level when we talk about me. We talked 40 years ago when you had one parent working and one at home, and I remember those days. I'm one of 12 children, so I know about financial literacy and the need and the lack of it. I'm also a father of six kids who every time I look around, they ask me, well, Dad, how can I get $10 out of you? I said, well, let me tell you how you can go out and earn $10 rather than dig it in my pocket. But in terms of a banker and learning, how did Bank of the West get involved with Operation Hope? And what opportunities are there for you? Well, John called me a visionary. Well, visionary in the sense that I attended a discussion in Los Angeles that John Bryan, who was the presenter. And I heard what he said in terms of passion. What is it that I can do? What is it that your institution can do? And again, it's centered around the lack of financial literacy in the terms of leading to building wealth, because wealth is what it's all about. I've also learned that if you teach people to do for themselves, become self-sufficient, they can do for themselves, their families, and others. So I took that passion that John had, along with my sense of urgency in terms of the footprint that Bank of the West was serving, and I went to my president and I said, look, I met this young man, and I think that he is on the right road in terms of teaching financial literacy. And I think our institution, Bank of the West, is in a position to be able to bring this to the fore in the footprint that we have. So he listened to me, and I think the compassion that I brought was that Bank of the West should be involved. And lo and behold, I think I must have moved him. And he said, what is it that Bank of the West can do in order to help John Bryan and the community build this need or the outreach for financial literacy? So I told him, this was in 1999, and I said, look, let's do a pilot program. Let's get into schoolrooms. Let's try and teach kids about financial literacy because they don't have it in schools, as you know, today. So we started with, I think, 10 banker teachers. We taught them in terms of what it is that the financial literacy was all about. We taught them the curriculum that was necessary that was not being taught in the school. Fast forward. A year later, we had educated 532 third graders through 12th grade students in the city schools of Oakland. That was a feat for us that we had no idea that we could accomplish through 10 teachers. And then I took that result to the president and say, look, this is what Bank of the West, partnering with Operation Hope, has done for 500 people in the school. I said, not only that, we're talking about future customers of the bank as well. So you got to take a look at that. And I think at that point, he said, what is it that we can do to expand the operations of financial literacy? And today, we are in Los Angeles, Portland, we are about to go to Denver and Oakland. We have taught right at 2,000 students in terms of financial literacy, in terms of what it is that they could do. So in order to build some sort of interest from the kids, we have developed a matching funds program. So every student that completes the curriculum, there are four curriculums part of it, models, that if you finish that, Bank of the West will do a matching funds dollar, or up to $50 for every student that finishes this class. Right now we have somewhere in the neighborhood of about 250 kids who are taking advantage of that matching funds, who never do anything about a savings account, never do anything about saving the money. And I think the point was made earlier that they would go home with their and speak with their parents about how do I get financial, they didn't know as well, so they couldn't teach them. So if the need is there, Bank of the West is part of it. We hope that Operation Hope and Bank of the West solidify this national partnership that we will be taking to Denver and then hopefully to Minneapolis. And with that, John, on financial literacy, it is great to be a partner of Operation Hope.
Thank you, Mark. We have now, Art mentioned the number 2,000 kids. That's just the number of kids that they educated. We have now, they started with 10 volunteers in Oakland. Because of their leadership, other institutions joined in, because you can't do it by yourself. We have now over 100 volunteers in Oakland alone. We have 2,800 Hope Corps volunteers nationwide. We've educated, hold on, 161,000 children in financial literacy, 35 kids at a time, in checking, savings, credit, investment, and the history of financial services. And now we're the only national urban delivery platform for financial literacy in the country. Our goal, 5 million urban and rural low-wealth children in 5 years, 25,000 volunteer Hope Corps members, 1,000 leading companies, and to spark a movement in this country. It's not going to be one Art Shewington, it's going to be 1,000 of them. State Farm Bank is here as our partner. And it's going to be a number of institutions. This has to become an industry priority because it is a national crisis. But what I'm saying is, this is not pure charity, this is a market-driven opportunity. You can do well and do good. You can do well by doing good. Thank you.
On the other side, John mentioned earlier just a brief about the Hope Center. In that partnership that came out of the Banking with Our Future financial literacy program, Bank of the West joined with Operation Hope with the Hope Center in Oakland, and it was a prototype that didn't exist before in Southern California, where Bank of the West and Operation Hope joined together and we build the Hope Center from the ground up, whereas Operation Hope and Bank of the West occupy the same building in terms of the outreach to the citizens of Oakland. And right at this point, we are somewhere in the neighborhood of about 1,500 people who have learned financial literacy on the internet, who are able to get in and become financial literacy wise that they didn't have before. And with that partnership, we hope they will take that to Denver as well in terms of the outreach to the community and another prototype Hope Center in Denver. So thank you, John.
Okay, we have a little bit of time for some questions and answers. If anybody has a question, please raise your hand.
On your teacher program that you have, you're saying that you're teaching 500 kids, children. Is that part of a regular school curriculum, or is it after school or before school, or is it being done in conjunction with Boys and Girls Clubs, Girls Inc., or how does that work, if you can explain that a little bit?
Yes, the program with Bank of the West is in conjunction with the operation of the school on a daily basis. They don't teach it in school as teachers, but banker teachers come in. Bankers who have been trained come into the school, and we teach the class in the regular school session of the school day. Once those kids are graduate from that, then we match them in with up to $50, and those accounts are maintained at the bank, and it's limited to a year's restriction as to what they can do so they can get used to saving, getting used to handling a savings account and learning more about it. So it's done within the school system on doing school teaching time.
If we subscribe to the notion that a more highly educated consumer is less likely to be victimized by predatory lending or abusive lending practices, which I sense that both John and Art might agree with. From Fannie Mae's perspective, have we looked to see, in my thinking is that financial education has lagged behind the market and is still concentrating on whether or not the person got the loan. It's not really moved into an area of what price they're paying. So has Fannie Mae looked at data not only in terms of people that are going from home counselor online, but what type of loan they're actually receiving, and if they're receiving loans that they should?
The answer is yes. I think we've all been sensitized in the last year or two to what's been happening in the marketplace. I think, you know, certainly we've had a long-standing issue where predatory lenders have picked particularly minority communities to ply their trade. But I think we've seen it actually go beyond that in this latest market run-up, where we have, you know, very hot real estate markets and, you know, the Los Angeleses, the Bostons, the Washingtons of the world. And even people who were counselors told us that in order to get into the home, they took a higher risky, more predatory product. So I think we're very much aware of that. I think this is probably one of the next frontiers is, what are the, getting people into the right risk basket for themselves. I think we talk about B and C lending. If you're legitimately a B or C, that's fine. But if you're an otherwise, A or A minus credit, you shouldn't be in those products. So we've done a lot of work along that at Fannie Mae, and I think a lot of others in the market. But and the data is coming out because of these hot real estate markets that there has been really an explosion in this. Wall Street securitizes a lot of this, so there is a secondary market outlet that maybe wasn't there 10 years ago. So at one point, there was a huge percent of ownership going into this, and it wasn't all just, in effect, to your question, people that didn't know any better. I mean, I think they just saw this as, I've got to get into a house, I got to get into it now, this is the product that gets me into the house, and if I miss out on this 2 years later, I'm not going to be able to afford it. So I think it goes both ways.
Just to follow up to the question that was asked earlier with me in terms of other outreach, it's Banking on Our Future program, which is part of the partnership with Operation Hope, as to how we do that in terms of going into the schools, as well as alternative schools, as well as Boys and Girls Clubs, and I think that was part of your question. The answer is yes, we do that as well.
John, does your program work at all with VITA, volunteering through tax assistance sites, and providing financial education to the people that are qualified to go through those sites?
No and yes. We partner with some nonprofits that are VITA sites. We have not yet linked the two together. It's a brilliant suggestion that you just unintentionally made. And as a social entrepreneur, I'll make sure we follow up on it before tax time. We have partnered, though, with H&R Block, oddly enough. And we have an agreement in principle right now that the H&R Block wants to bring financial literacy inside of every H&R Block office to make sure that people are making a decision for, say, a refund anticipation loan that they shouldn't be making. And we're going to kind of be the honest broker that's in the middle of that transaction, which is another kind of version of what you're talking about. But yeah, that's a great suggestion.
John, do you think that we as an industry are part of the problem, we bankers as an industry, because of the fact that we make credit cards so easily accessible to the youth of America and even install access devices at McDonald's and other?
It's a bit of a trick question because you really can't win with the answer. You're part of the problem, no doubt about it, but you're also part of the solution. I mean, thank God for regulated institutions. You know, a lot of the problem with predatory lending is mortgage brokers and mortgage bankers and unregulated lenders who are unscrupulous, frankly, who have no reputation risk. And by the way, to your point, you can pass a law against predatory lending, but you cannot protect my father from himself. Because my dad doesn't ask you what the interest rate is, he asks you what the payment is. It's a very big question. And Martin Luther King once said in 68, you can't legislate goodness, you can't pass a law to force someone to respect you. The only way to social justice is through economic parity. So it's ownership, but it's also education. I think that, you gotta be responsible. You just can't be a hardcore capitalist, with no morals, no ethics, and no sense of balance. I think that all things in balance, drugs that are prescribed are actually good for you. Alcohol in moderation will bring your blood pressure down. But you go buck wild with any of those things and they're not good for you. And I think that there's been a lot of instances where, in the pure name of capitalism and market access, supposedly, I mean, you had ATM machines in high schools. I would argue that that's not good. You've got credit cards being accepted at McDonald's, where a financially illiterate mother thinks that they can, feed their family of three for $9, and somehow that's actually good for them. They're actually eating food, she thinks. There's a place for fast food. I'm not sure it should be the daily diet for people. And when you swipe that credit card, you're not aware, you're not really thinking about it as real money. I think it's easier to do that than actually put a $10 bill on the table. So I think there's a lot of issues here, and it's complicated. But I think that the financial services industry has a responsibility. And I think that when you do it well, it protects your customer that you're making money off of. So you actually do better if you do it this way. All I'm suggesting is doing well by doing good. I'm not suggesting to burden down the industry or to put bridles on it. I think that I believe in free markets. I believe in capitalism. I just believe in a balanced approach, a responsible approach.
John, could you give the audience a brief description of the modules in the banking and the future planning and improving the schools? I think it'd be good for them to
know. Well, I don't know. You should do it. You're the co-founder of Banking on Our Future. That's where it started in 1996 with the first child with Fremont Investment Loan. There's four modules: checking, savings, credit, investment, and there's an alternate model on insurance and the history of financial services. Each model is 45 minutes. It's like career day. And I am against, by the way, the once a year things people do. They go in, they do 1 year of whatever it is, one day once a year. This has to be every day of the school year. We're the largest capitalist country in the world, and no one's teaching our children life one-on-one skills. I mean, and I'm talking about the basics: checking, savings, credit, investment, the history of banking. So what we do is try to regularize it. It's four modules. You can teach, this person here could teach one module in a school, and then she could say, well, John, I'm busy tomorrow. I can't teach the second module, and somebody else could go and teach the second module because they're individual modules. So it's an hour commitment, basically, by a volunteer. And you can do it during the school day, you can do it after school, you can do it in a faith-based institution on weekends. So we made it really simple. We give you 2 hours of training. We certify you as a Hope Corps member. We're in 500 schools. And so we try to make it just as simple as possible for the teacher to teach. And it's frankly, a relief for the schools because, we already mentioned that the number one cause of divorce in America is money. Last time I checked, teachers were married too. So the teacher doesn't want to tell you they're financially literate themselves. They can't balance their own checkbook. So how do you teach a child something you don't understand yourself? By having you go in, you're doing the teacher and the student a favor.
Yeah, I think that's all we have time for. Let's give this panel a big hand.
Unplanned.